Join us as we listen closely to voices that still echo from our nation's past. Distant, even obscure, but all the more exciting for that mystery. It's where fascinating women discuss fascinating women's histories. I'm Tzipporah Weinberg, and this is Veiled Reference. Let's take a deep dive into pockets of history preserved in our Torah sources. With each episode, we'll travel back in time to discover and recover stories of women who might have otherwise been lost to us. Piecing together the tales of these women of old can help us to understand periods of time that we've only hazily conceived of before. It's time to let these women's voices rise to the surface through the sources left to us, and to learn about the lives they led, and maybe draw inspiration and strength to empower each one of us on our own journeys. Welcome all. I want to thank all of you for the amazingly warm reception and for all of the feedback to our previous episodes. It's been fantastic to hear your thoughts and comments, both on the content and style of Veiled Reference. Yes, this is a unique endeavor, and it's dedicated to you, our listeners. So your opinions and reflections mean so much. Keep them coming, please. And today, there's a treat in store. Professor Eve Krakowski of Princeton and of Passaic, Shnei Ksarim, if you will, is here. Now, until very recently, I was unaware that the path-breaking scholar of the Cairo Geniza was also a regular, well, I don't know if you can be called regular if you're as brilliant and accomplished as Eve, but a frum mommy from New Jersey, with whom you could have a coffee conversation at PTA. And now we get to have that coffee conversation with her as she leads us through the mysterious, compelling world of the Cairo Geniza. Eve, before we begin, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast and for the very kind words. I should say I'm not the scholar, but I am a scholar of the Geniza, which is a really wonderful field of Jewish history. That's unusual because it's focused not just on leaders and Talmidei Chachamim, but also on how ordinary Jews lived their lives and experienced the world in the Middle Ages. So this is something that is really not possible in most fields of pre-modern Jewish history. And for us, it is. So what does it mean that I am a scholar? So I work at Princeton. I teach students, both college students and graduate students. Mostly I do research and I write articles and books, actually so far one book, about this world and also about the history of Judaism in this world. As for me, I grew up in Chicago and I've lived in New Jersey for the last 13 years. And I currently have 7 children at home. My oldest is 21 and my youngest is almost 4.
Amazing. And I think you mentioned your book. To fully grasp the scope of what you do, you have to familiarize yourself with Eve Krakowski's scholarship. I've just finished reading Coming of Age in Medieval Egypt, Female Adolescence, Jewish Law, and Ordinary Culture, which is Eve's most recent book. And in that book, you transport us to the climes of the Cairo Geniza through the lens of the women of that time period. And I get to take you all along with me right now into that distant atmosphere of Geniza society with Eve as our guide. So first, what is the Cairo Geniza? We recognize each of these terms independently. Cairo is Egypt's capital, and the word Geniza is used synonymously with what the Ashkenazic vernacular terms Shemus, as in, oh, here's an old, unusable sitter, needs to be put in Shemus. And the Cairo Geniza was just this type of repository, located in the Ben Ezra Synagogue in Fustat, which was at the time adjacent to Cairo. Now, we might be familiar with the name Fustat as a place where the Rambam was a leader from the 1160s until his passing in 1204. This Ben Ezra Geniza served as a warehouse for a huge variety of primarily Jewish texts and Jewish documents for a large but limited amount of time, over 3 centuries, and a large but limited geographical location spanning more than 2,000 miles. The vast majority of the material is dated from the 11th to 13th century and centered in the area from Iraq to current-day Morocco, but most of it is from Egypt and present-day Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. So there, for so many years, was a collection of documents that serve today as a time capsule, revealing all sorts of things about how people lived, died, worked, learned, married, argued, and made peace. And the deciphering is still ongoing as historians all over the world make meaning of the fragments in the synagogue, so many of which are still unstudied. Now, unlike archaeological digs that are generally discovered underground, historians like Eve are so proud of and grateful to the people of the Beit Knesset Ben Ezra for cordoning off a room in their synagogue as a permanent geniza, instead of using a box or some other form of temporary storage that would periodically be buried from time to time, as often happens. If that had happened, the historical treasure trove of hundreds of thousands of texts would have been lost to us forever. And instead, here we are, discussing some of the glorious finds of the Cairo Geniza together. What we all want to know is how and when did this accidental collection of manuscripts accumulated over these nine centuries come to light in the modern world? So the answer is, it's complicated. The vault was authoritatively discovered by European and American scholars in the late 19th century. Today, the Geniza's contents are scattered across some 70 libraries and private collections in Europe and the United States. Eve, can you please tell us more about these collections and about how they were unearthed?
Absolutely. So there was a Jewish population in Egypt probably continuously from antiquity until actually even now, although the population now is minuscule. But the Geniza, what we're calling the Geniza, we don't actually even know where it was located, but it was some kind of room or chamber inside a synagogue that remained standing from the 10th century in what's now called Old Cairo. It's part of Cairo now, but at the time it was its own independent city called Fustat. And the synagogue remained standing from the 10th century through the 19th as an active synagogue. It's actually still standing now, although now it's basically just a tourist site. So we have no Geniza document or text that talks about the practice of Geniza. So we don't actually have direct evidence for why these papers were deposited in this room. Mm-hmm. But it seems strongly connected to the idea of Shemos. But for these Jews, Shemos, what we call Shemos, seems to have encompassed a lot more than we would expect. So there are many, many fragments of text that make sense to put in Shemos. So many, many fragments of Tefillah, of Piyut, of Gemara, many, many fragments of not actually Torah scrolls, but of what we call codices, meaning, you know, pages from a written out Torah that's meant to be studied from, like the Aleppo Codex. So basically the entire library of educated Jews of the period. But we also have other kinds of literature that's not religious or even Jewish at all, fragments of medical writings. Much of this material is in Judeo-Arabic, so it's Arabic language written in Hebrew script, as in fact, I should say, is much of the religious literature as well. So theology, philosophy, biblical commentaries, they were all written in Judeo-Arabic at the time.
That could be comparable for our listeners, just to understand as kind of a Yiddish-style vernacular of the Arabic language.
Yes, absolutely. It's equivalent to Ladino or to Yiddish, although it's worth noting that it was much less of a separate dialect than Yiddish is, meaning we think that really the Geniza actually gives us the best picture of the everyday spoken Arabic of the day that everyone, Muslims and Christians, as well as Jews, would have spoken. It's just written in Hebrew script and it has Hebrew words and phrases and certain specific Jewish words in it. But in terms of sort of the everyday tone and idiom and vocabulary in these writings, they're probably just sort of the general Arabic of the day.
And that might also speak to the less distinctive or the more permeable boundaries between Arabic and Jewish culture at the time.
Absolutely.
Whereas Yiddish was a specifically Jewish vernacular.
Right, 100%. So the Jews were much more, in many ways, sort of part of the everyday life of cities in this region, and certainly Fustat, than what we tend to think of for Jews in the European Middle Ages.
Fascinating.
And we know that's true. Actually, a small but still enormous section of this corpus, of this group of writings that were put in this part of the synagogue. So about 10% of the Geniza, which is still about 40,000 pieces of paper, are documents. Really, the easier way to understand this is that they're everyday writings. We don't know why these things were put into Shemos. They mostly don't have God's name. Some don't have anything to do with Judaism even. Some are not even in Hebrew script. But we're talking about things like merchants' letters, family letters, documents of the Beit Din, petitions to the government, which are not in Judeo-Arabic. They're in Arabic script Arabic. So they're petitions that were written to send to the Fatimid Empire, which ruled over Egypt in this period. Merchants' accounts talking about the merchandise that people are trading across the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean. Lists of people receiving charity, and even doodles, which are some of the funnest things to come across. So it's not entirely clear why all this material was deposited in the Geniza, but we are very lucky that it was, because it gives us this incredibly close-up view of the society and allows us to see really how deeply part of the society of the day Jews were. And in fact, there are increasingly historians who are not studying Jews specifically who learn Judeo-Arabic so they can access the Geniza in order to understand what life in Egypt and Syria was like at that time more broadly. The Geniza was, we think, continued to have things deposited in it from the 10th century all the way to the late 19th century. Probably by the late 19th century, people weren't actively using it anymore, but certainly in the 18th and maybe early 19th centuries, they were. And how did it turn from a place that people actively used for this purpose to a historical source? It's actually part of the story of 19th century Cairo. So 19th century Cairo was undergoing a building boom and sort of an antiquities rush. So people from Europe, from America, were coming to the Near East to find antiquities, to purchase antiquities. And as part of this story, Cairo is being completely rebuilt. And so the synagogue is actually half destroyed so that it can be rebuilt. And in the process of remodeling, somehow the Geniza was recovered or rediscovered, and things started trickling out onto the antiquities market. And a fragment, which turned out to be the lost Hebrew version of Ben Sira, made its way to Cambridge, England, where a scholar named Solomon Schechter discovered it. And that is sort of the most famous story of how scholars became aware of the Geniza. Eventually, groups of these fragments were purchased by antiquities dealers, sometimes collected by scholars themselves with the Jewish community's permission, and brought to libraries across Europe, in Israel, and the U.S., which is where they currently are. So even though the synagogue is still standing in Egypt, there are no more Geniza fragments there, as far as we know, at least none of the ones that were originally discovered in the late 19th century.
As I was thinking about this episode, it struck me that the Cairo Geniza was initially brought to its larger audience and to Solomon Schechter, as you mentioned, by a couple of women, sister historians, enthusiasts, linguists, collectors, these learned women, Agnes Lewis and Margaret Gibson of Scotland. And that women's thread is continuous. One of the distinctive facets of the Cairo Geniza is the window it provides into medieval women's lives, their culture, and their particular circumstances in youth, marriage, and widowhood. I was so excited to learn that, in fact, it is one of the only sources of the time period that let us understand how women came of age, whom they associated with, and what their struggles were. Eve, when I was imagining what you do this by first deciphering fragments, which the untrained eye would find impossible, and then comparing the Judeo-Arabic or Arabic or Aramaic texts to, just to name one other textual base, to contemporaneous responsa literature, Shilas Tshuvas. And how do you do that comparing? You look at linguistic clues for semantic nuances. You look at societal norms and literature from the surrounding cultures, and you reconstruct this medieval Levantine world. When I first approached you about this idea of discussing women in the Cairo Geniza, I was not aware that you had in fact written a book on just this topic. I was approaching you after reading Joel Kramer's work on the Spanish women of the Geniza. Do you remember that first conversation?
Yep, I do.
Your book explores the Cairo Geniza through the lens of women's adolescence. And you so modestly said at the time, but you don't have to read my book. But of course I did. And it was so wonderful. And it is. And I got to learn about Sitt al-Dar, who was living with her future husband's family for 3 years, only to be plucked away by her father and then engaged to her cousin instead. I met Haifa bin Suleiman, who arrived in Fustat with her 2-year-old son, hoping desperately to find her runaway husband. And I learned about the wealthy and colorful and bold Wuhsha al-Dalala, whose escapades unfold at length within Geniza texts. And then I knew that embedded in these documents are stories we need to tell. So Eve, please tell us more about the kinds of sources we have for women within the Geniza.
Yes. So mostly when we study the Middle Ages, whether it's Jews or anyone else, in the Near East specifically, in this region, what we know about are people at court or learned men. So very sort of important people who somebody would have wanted to chronicle and write down their lives for posterity for various reasons. The Geniza is totally different, because we have these little snippets of people doing things in real time, and we have an incredible amount of them. And so it's like a giant jigsaw puzzle. As you say, we try to put all the pieces from different documents together and then compare them to other texts of the period to understand them, to understand why are people using this phrase and what does it mean. So for women in particular, women did an incredible range of things in this society that make their way into writing, especially involving marriage and property. So sadly, we don't have evidence for things like How did women socialize with each other in their time off? Or what did they gossip about? That we don't have so much. We have a little bit, but not as much. But we have a tremendous, tremendous amount surrounding women's marriages, both at the time of marriage, throughout the marriage, and after the marriage, after women either get divorced or their husband dies, or as often happened, well, it shows up a lot anyway in writing, the husband ran off and left them alone as an aguna. So that was the aguna problem of the day. We have things like marriage contracts, ketubot, but they're not like the ketubah that we're familiar with, which is set and fixed and looks pretty much the same except for the names and locations for every couple. These marriage contracts did have a lot of fixed language, but they also had particular clauses specific to the marriage that tell us about the couple's relationship. We have contracts that couples wrote up in the Beit Din when they were fighting with each other. We have letters that husbands wrote to their wives and that wives' relatives wrote to their husbands. We also have family letters, many, many letters dictated by women and some possibly even written by women themselves, talking about all kinds of things, how they miss their son who's gone away on a business trip and hasn't come home. And, you know, we have many actually sort of maternal guilt letters in the Geniza. We have petitions to the state from poor women, also to local communal leaders from poor women who are in all kinds of various trouble and need help. So we get a kind of huge range from the very poorest women to the very wealthiest women, insight into what women could do socially, what their relationships were like, who they turned to when they were in trouble, which is something that we just absolutely do not have from any other source base for this period.
It's just so interesting to hear that, you know, these two sides were represented. And in terms of understanding that middle ground, it's always the people who have a complaint are the ones who leave comments like on websites and things like that. Like we're hearing the voices of those who are either in these very wealthy spots and they're arranging, you know, their affairs and they have documentation for their wills, and or you're hearing people in very dire straits, women who need to turn to authority. So those two extremes, it's just fascinating that that's what we get. And we still have to fill in, kind of color in the shading to try to extrapolate as to what the average woman of that time period looks like.
Yes, that is a really, really wonderful point. And I should say, I started with women whose husbands have run off and women who are in trouble. And we get a lot of sort of the terrible stories. And that's because that's what made its way into writing. And so we do always have to stop and think about, you know, what did the women to whom terrible things like this did not happen and who didn't have to write petitions, what were their lives like?
Such a rich and exciting field to be in, to be able to have that ability to see into the daily lives of marriages of the people of that time and place. And today we get to focus on three women captured in the manuscripts of the Cairo Geniza that each tell us something about women's ideas and what it meant to be Jewish to them, both their internal sense of the Jewish experience and how that manifested itself in their active lives. So first, let's explore the last will and testament of Chula bin Shabbat. Eve, can you read the document for us?
Yes, I can. So this is a document. It exists in translation, and I'm going to read the translation that my colleague Mark Cohn did of this document. It's really one of my favorite documents from the Geniza. Actually, all three of the ones we're going to read are my favorites. This is from probably the 1130s, and it's a copy of a will that is written down because it's being brought before the Beit Din, presumably to validate it, to confirm it. And it reads like this. This is a copy of the will of Chula bint Shabbat, so Chula, the daughter of Shabbat, which was brought before the court, the Beit Din, with everything that it contains written in the hand of Yehuda, the son of the scribe. We copied it fully with its witnesses, letter by letter, word by word. And then you get the will itself. And it goes like this. Testimony that took place before us, we, the witnesses who signed below, as follows. We came before Chula bint Shabbat, and she said to us, bear witness for me with all the necessary words and types of testimony that I affirm before you. So that was all boilerplate. And now we come to the part where she actually starts saying what she wants to happen with her property. So she says, I possess 1/3 of a house in Pesar Hashem in partnership with my brothers, and 1/3 of a house near the Inn of the Habi in partnership with the son of her sister. That's a little like mistake on the scribe's part. It should say the son of my sister, but he put it in third person. And 2 2/3 portions of the house of the Chedia in partnership with her brothers. Okay, so this is already, we know, a very wealthy woman. She owns portions of 3 different houses. And these houses are probably not one-story, one-family houses. We know that in this period, urban real estate, for the most part in Fustat, we're talking about multi-apartment buildings built around a courtyard. And so people owned them, owned portions of them very often. And we also see from this document right away the way in which wealthy women typically acquire property is from their family, usually when they're married as a dowry. And we know that from the document because she owns all of these properties in partnership with her relatives, her brothers and her nephew. So she comes from a wealthy family who has transmitted quite a lot of property to her, which is very, very common for wealthy women. And she is listing it all so she can then give it away, or rather say where it will be given after she dies. She also has a male slave, a ghulam, who is to be sold, and the proceeds should be divided equally. So meaning the proceeds from selling off this enslaved man, one half for the upkeep of Damu, which is, we know about this site. It's a pilgrimage site. It's a synagogue outside Fustat that people go to on pilgrimage. So she wants half of this money to go to the upkeep of this Jewish pilgrimage site and the other half to remain with the Beit Din, designated for someone who dies impoverished or to a person who gets detained on account of the poll tax, which is a special tax that Jews and Christians have to pay in Muslim states during this period and doesn't have the means to extricate himself. So again, she wants to leave this all to charity, and she's dividing it up to charity to keep up a pilgrimage site and charity to help somebody who needs it, who's kind of among the poorest of the poor, someone who dies without any money to be buried or somebody who is imprisoned because they can't pay the poll tax.
So she's asserting her will right now. And then the document tells us that there's more.
Right, exactly. So those are her wishes. And interestingly, there are things weird about this document, but I'm not going to get into it. But if, you know, some of you sort of with sharp ears notice that she doesn't say what's supposed to happen to all of her real estate, that's true. It doesn't say. And maybe it's because the copy left that out because they're really only concerned with this slave. But in any case, she says this, that she wants this slave to be sold off and divided this way for charity. And then the witnesses who are men and who would have been probably sort of men who had functions within the official organized community of Fustat, so kind of leaders of the community, we suggested to her that in the synagogue of the Iraqis and Palestinians, there is a Bible codex worth a certain sum. So what this would have been would probably almost certainly be a kind of big, beautiful, expensive book of the Torah with all the sort of vocalization and notes, what we call a Masoretic Codex. For those of you who are familiar with the Aleppo Codex or the Sassoon Codex, which recently sold for some insane sum of money, something like that. And synagogues owned these, and they were part of the synagogue's prestige. And these men are suggesting to her, they say, we suggested that the money be designated for its restoration. So this beautiful copy of the Torah, you know, has fallen into some kind of disrepair, and they want the money to be used to hire a scribe to fix it. But she said no. And she goes on to take care of some of her other sort of bequests. She acquits her brothers of all claims and demands, meaning her heirs are not going to come sue her brothers for money. And then fascinatingly, she also stated that she owes her slave 2 dinars, which is not an insignificant amount of money, and also 6 dinars to her niece. And then there's the kind of final language summing up the will. So this is the kind of evidence we have in legal documents, a little snippet into this woman's life. We don't know anything else about her, but we can infer quite a lot, putting it in context of all the other documents we have. And what's unique about it is her refusal to go along with their request that this copy of Tanakh be repaired.
It's so intriguing, and it makes me think of so many different questions. First of all, the idea that this is a woman who is an upper middle class woman who owns significant property and she's making her own choices. And there's no mention of a husband here, is there?
No, there isn't. And it seems that most women in the Geniza seem to have married at some point. We very, very infrequently hear about lifelong single women.
There's certainly no voice of a husband coming in and telling her what to do. And when she has her brothers as people that she's in business with, but when she seems very fully empowered to be able to say that she doesn't want her money to be spent after her death, you know, the way she's not interested in having it spent. And it makes me wonder about why she refused to fund the repair of this codex. Is it because she was illiterate?
Right. So first, I should say this is not unusual. Not all women had this kind of agency and choice, but women who owned a lot of property, when we see them in documents, they do.
Yeah.
They are doing things even when their husband is present. it's certainly possible that they, you know, hadn't fully made the decision themselves, but at least in court, they're acting for themselves. And this woman is remarkable because, as you say, she sort of just refuses the request of the leaders. So we don't know if she was illiterate. We have a couple of references to women in the Geniza who can read Hebrew and who are quite learned, including a very beautiful letter by a brother to his sister after their mother died, sort of telling her to stop weeping and to try to accept it, even though they're both, you know, in terrible mourning. And he tells her, read Eov and read Kohelet, and that will help you.
Mm-hmm.
So there are women who are literate, presumably wealthy women, and even probably a subset of wealthy women. We don't know about this woman, but this document, I can't say responsibly as a historian that what I'm about to say is true. But my gut feeling, that what I like to think about this woman is that she either doesn't know how to read or certainly has never had contact herself with this codex. And for her, sort of her expression of what she wants done with her money has to do with these forms of religion, which are really very central to women's lives in this period. Pilgrimage and helping the poor.
But you also begin the book with this petition by a woman who wants to make sure that these two teenagers who live next to her end up with the ability to read Shema, right? And she asks for money for that. So there's definitely a value for the education of women that they not be barbaric. She calls them like animals, right? Let them not grow up like animals. Let them know how to read Kriya Shema.
Right. So I'm not sure, it's not clear there if it's that they should know how to simply recite it or should read it, but it's absolutely clear from that document and from others that there is a value placed on women having sort of what we would think of as a very basic religious education. But the ability to value, you know, a Masoretic Codex, one of these incredibly expensive, prestigious codices, is something that maybe a woman wouldn't have connected with as much. On the other hand, I should make it very clear that that's just this woman, right? Women are not a kind of identical group of people that are all leading the same lives. I think we've already, you know, made that clear in what we've said so far. And we also have documents where women want to spend enormous sums of money to ensure that their sons get a very high level Torah education. So it's not that all women wouldn't have connected with the kind of learning you can do from a codex like this, but it seems like this woman didn't.
And is also significant when you juxtapose it with the Rambam's assessment of women's capacity at that time to learn.
Right.
So that also helps us understand a little bit about why she might not be connecting.
Right.
You know, that this is not something that was seen as within the purview of women. So we're getting a sense that women in 1135 in Egypt could make decisions about how they wanted their money spent, even after their deaths, and that's a power that we might not have assumed belonged to them at that point in time. And next, we're going to meet a woman whom I call privately to myself, the Davening Almana. Hers is a very poignant petition, apparently written to Avraham ben Arambam, about a widow who lived in a small upper apartment of a ruin with no closet, no vestibule, no solid wall, no standing roof, I quote. The apartment wasn't hers. It was a property of the communal tzedakah fund, Hekdesh. But she did have to pay a very small rental fee, which had just increased. And the widow, who has a son who leaves very early in the morning and doesn't come back till late at night, states that she has no love for the apartment. But when she sits in her house, she hears the chazan in his synagogue saying Kadosh, Baruch, and Kaddish. And she therefore asks not to be removed from the apartment, so that she can continue to benefit from these proximal blessings. So here was a woman who appreciated the value of being next to a Beit Knesset, sitting at home, enjoying the sound of prayers flowing into the wall-less ruin that she was living in. It's clear just how important it was for her and to what length she was willing to go to retain it. And this mixture of passivity and initiative is another hint of women's spirituality within Geniza society. It makes us think about whether women actually went to Beit Knesset or not. Was this the closest you could get to that shul experience that we know today? Or does this skew to the conceptions of modesty of the time in that women didn't leave their houses as a matter of course?
Yeah, this is such a beautiful, beautiful document. It was discovered by my colleague Oded Zinger, and it's really unusual in giving us a glimpse into sort of the internal religiosity of a woman at all, and especially of a woman like this. So this is a poor woman. She's living on communal charity, and the apartment she's living in, just to sort of bring it to light, it's a ruined building. So actually, we have this quite frequently in Geniza documents when we're talking about housing of the poor, we're literally talking about a kind of old building, sometimes even, you know, a very, very, very old building that is not actually fully standing. Maybe the roof has caved in or the wall has caved in, but people are still sheltering there. And this woman is living there and she hates it, but she makes this very beautiful request to stay there because she can hear the davening. So this is sort of a very clear expression of the way in which she is accessing tefillah. And your question about modesty is an excellent one. So we do not know actually what the women's section of the synagogue looked like in this period, because the synagogue as it stands now, remember, it was rebuilt in the late 19th century. So it does not look like the medieval synagogue would have looked. And as far as I know, we don't have any physical descriptions, but we do have a couple of letters where people mention meeting a woman in synagogue on Shabbat.
Oh.
So it seems like women could have attended. But I am assuming that they probably did not attend daily prayers three times a day, and that this woman is finding a sense of meaning in being right next door and being able to hear the prayers come through her window every day. What's very interesting in terms of modesty is that my guess is that this woman left her house and left her house often because she had to.
Oh, wow.
What we find about modesty in Geniza documents is a completely different conception of tzniut than what we have today. So much of women's education today is focused on what you can wear and what you can't wear. That is almost entirely absent. In fact, it is entirely absent, as far as I know, from the texts of this period, even though Jewish women, like all women in Fustat, were probably much more covered up than what we consider necessary. So we have a tremendous amount of descriptions of clothing in dowry lists. We don't always know what the clothing is. So if there's this wonderful book by the scholar Yedida Stillman that goes through all of these terms and explains what they are, and really, like many of them, she just says some kind of mantle, some kind of cloak, some kind of wrap.
For veiled reference, we should ask if they actually, women wore veils. I mean,
so, yes, enslaved women did not wear veils, but it seems like everybody else did, actually. And so what they mean by tzniut in this period is not what you wear, but how often you leave the house. Hmm. And again, they're living in courtyard buildings, so it doesn't mean that you never get to have fresh air. Being in the courtyard of your own building, I think, is not considered going out, is the expression they word. But women who go out of the house to the market, etc. My takeaway after reading a lot of these marriage contracts where they talk about it, a lot of tshuvot where they talk about it, is that it's as much a class issue as it is a religious issue, meaning women of kind of the upper class, the wealthy, educated, elite women. It's a special sort of status symbol that you don't go out, whereas poor women cannot afford that. They don't have slaves.
Right.
They often, the poor women who are really in dire straits, like this woman, they also don't have relatives who they're living with who help them. And so they need to go out. They need to go out to get water. They need to go out to get food. They possibly need to go out to earn money, or at least, you know, if they're working on fabric, to get the materials to work with.
Mm.
And so this woman probably did leave the house.
And the word that's used for going out is in Judeo-Arabic, or is it yatsanit, or like recalls like dina?
Actually, dina is brought up in, I think, I don't want to misquote because I studied this all a very long time ago, but I think it's in Avram ben Arambam's commentary on the Torah. In talking about this issue, he talks about dina.
Really?
So I don't think yatsanit is used, but that is the concept.
So it's used in its Arabic form when it talks about going out, like the women who go out.
Exactly.
Right.
Or women who don't go out, women who are sheltered in their homes, is appears in one document.
Interesting. That's fascinating. So, yeah. So just this piety of this woman and the connection that she feels to the tefillah, to the davening, just is so resonant. It's something I think women of today will definitely recognize. And even, you know, women who pass by a shul and can't go to shul, or women who just want to hear sometimes, you know, just a little bit of Kaddish, Baruch Hu, is exactly this woman's experience. It just directly links us to that time in such a powerful way.
It does. And I want to say, because I think it's easy when you study this material, so much of which is about strife and difficulty and kind of, you know, jockeying for social status. It's easy to overlook things like this. And we have so few documents where things like this appear. And yet all of a sudden this pops up and you imagine that this was really the internal experience of many, many, many women.
Yeah.
It just often doesn't make its way into writing in the way that this particular case did.
And it just connects us as religious women. It takes the span of generations and centuries slips away. We are that woman. who wants to just listen sometimes to the davening.
Hopefully not living in a ruined building with the roof caving in, but yes.
Amazing. And our final woman that we meet is the wife of Basir, the bellmaker from Cairo.
So this actually complements the one that we just talked about very nicely. This is also one of my absolute all-time favorite Geniza documents. It's a little bit later than the typical sort of classical Geniza, where most of our documents come from. It comes from a later period in the 14th century where the community of Fustat has shrunk. The communal system is a little different. But some of the same genres of writing to communal leaders still persist. And this is an incredible document written probably by a scribe for a woman, but it's in the woman's voice, telling the following story. So she says, "In your name, O merciful, Bishimcha Rahmana," which is the kind of typical opening, exactly parallel to the Islamic opening in Arabic of letters, "to the high seat of our Lord, the Nagid." So this is the term used in this period for the head of the Jews in Egypt. "May his splendor be exalted and his honor great." The slave, the wife of Basir, the bellmaker. Okay, so first I should say she's not actually a slave, but it's part of the language of appeal that people who are appealing call themselves a slave. So that always is very confusing for students when they start reading these materials.
But not us, because we know Ani Avdecha Ben Amatecha.
Exactly.
We know this terminology.
So she's the wife of a bellmaker. So I am going to place her sort of on the spectrum of class, somewhere between the first woman with all the property who left her will and the second woman who's living in a ruin. She's kind of what we might call, quote unquote, you know, lower middle class, the wife of a craftsman. She kisses the ground and submits. So again, this is typical petition language. It actually comes from petitions submitted to the state, to the government, but it's also used to communal leaders, and submits that she has on her neck, meaning she has responsibility for three children, because her husband has become completely infatuated with life on the mountain with Al-Qurani, who is a known Sufi mystic, Islamic Sufi mystic of this period. Her Jewish husband has fallen in love with this group of mystics living on the mountain, in vain and to no purpose, a place where there is no Torah, no prayer, and no mention of God's name in truth. So this is her critique of what her husband is doing.
Right.
He goes up to the mountain and mingles with the beggars, although these have only the semblance, but not the essence of religion, which I should say is a criticism of Sufism that you find in sophisticated theological Jewish texts of this period, actually of an earlier period, coming out in this letter by this woman. And I don't know if it's her language or the scribe's language, but it's really interesting.
Right.
The slave is afraid, meaning she, the woman, is afraid that there may be some bad man who may induce her husband to forsake the Jewish faith, meaning to convert to Islam, and take with him the three children. She almost perishes because of her loneliness and her search after food for the little ones. It is her wish that our master, meaning the leader, the Nagid that she's writing to, go after her husband and take the matter up with him, according to his unfailing wisdom. And what the slave entreats him to do is not beyond his power nor the high degree of his influence. So here she's getting a little kick to the Nagid. Like,
yeah,
don't tell me you can't do this. You can do this.
You're empowered.
Then in the margin, so letters are often written kind of around the margin after you fill up the main space. The only thing which the slave wants is that her husband stop going up the mountain and that he may show mercy toward the little ones. If he wishes to devote himself to God, he may do so in the synagogue, attending regularly Shacharit, Mincha, and Ma'ariv. Those are in the Hebrew. And listening to the words of the Torah, but he should not occupy himself with useless things. Furthermore, he presses the slave, meaning he's trying to convince her to sell their house, to leave the Jewish community, and to stay on the mountain so that the little ones would stop studying Torah. It would be helpful if our Lord, again, meaning the Nagid she's writing to, gave orders to the slave in that matter and instructed her concerning it, for his wisdom is unfailing. And then Vishalom, which is like how you end a letter, and then there's two little extra notes. Our Lord, again, the Nagid, is in charge of a vast region. Thus, his high aspiration could not fail to prevent him from doing what I've said, from going up to the mountain and making him attend synagogue and occupying himself with his family. And then there's one other little note where she says that the Nagid has promised her child, the little one, a medicine for the ear. There is no harm in trying it out, seeing that even the barber is playing with it without experience. So here we have a little sort of window into kind of popular medical practice of the time.
Yeah.
May God have mercy. And that's the end of the letter.
So we have so much here. But first of all, it's this idea of a woman in dispute with her husband because he's abandoning a Jewish way of life, because he's become infatuated with Sufism. And she, as this Eishes Chayil, what does she do? She makes this urgent appeal to the head of the community. Go after my husband. Make sure that he stops going up the mountain, right? Like, let him find his place of devotion in Torah. If he wants to be religious, let him go to Beit Knesset.
Exactly.
And there's a certain force that comes through, a drive and an ability to make this claim that I hear resonating from this document. And especially where she says, you have the power as the Nagid to force my husband to do what he's supposed to do. Which also suggests to me that there was a place for this kind of petition. That there was a place for a woman's voice to address the Nagid in this way.
Yes, it's incredibly interesting. So the language here is a little different from most of the petitions we have, I think, because of the date. It's later. But the genre of women's petitions is kind of its own genre.
Hey.
And it's interesting. One of the things that comes out of the Geniza is that men have a wide variety of social relationships that they can draw on to try to get help with things. If they're poor, they can write to somebody that somebody told them about who gives charity. If they're not poor, they can write to a business associate or somebody they learned with or somebody who, you know, they've done a favor to in the past.
Yeah.
Women cannot do any of that unless it's to somebody related to them. So they don't pull on social relationships for help, but they very, very often write directly to communal leaders, asking them for help and to the state. And it's a kind of special power of the powerless, so to speak.
Yeah.
That women can draw on. And it clearly is something that, first of all, this has a history. It's not just in the Jewish community or in this period. There's a broader context of petitions like this that survived from Egypt from before the Islamic period and also in Islamic contexts. So this is a kind of a known thing that women can write directly to leaders for help. And it clearly must have worked because there are so many of them.
Right. That's what I was thinking, that it actually presumes that they will be responded to,
yeah.
That they will be taken seriously. Even the force of her language, even though she deprecates herself by calling herself a servant so many times, but it's clearly implied that she does expect some kind of response.
Yeah. This is somewhat unusual, the kind of sort of force with which she's nudging him.
Yeah.
Like, you know, don't tell me you can't do this. You can do
right.
this. And I don't know if it's because the community has gotten much smaller at this point. And there's more of an intimacy. Like, you wouldn't find in the 11th, 12th centuries a woman petitioning the head of the Jews and asking him about ear medicine.
Right. And I told you about my ear medicine that I needed. What
right.
about, like, you didn't fetch me my ear medicine.
What's really fascinating in this kind of pushing is that she's kind of giving a sermon of her own. And again, I don't know how much of it is the scribe's language or her language. So I can't responsibly say, like, I wouldn't put in writing in an article that here we see her internal world.
Right.
But I will tell you that I like to think about it this way. To me, this is such familiar language. So much about this document and this whole world is so unfamiliar, right? Like, the life on the mountain with the Sufis, this is not something from our world. But the language that she uses to say what is her conception of what he ought to be doing before
yes.
he goes off, you know, floating in the clouds,
yes.
doing all this nonsense. Why doesn't he try going to the synagogue 3 times a day
yes.
and listening to the Torah reading and saying his basic prayers? It sounds so much to me like her language and like something that, you know, you could hear from somebody down the street.
Again, bridging the generations just like that between, you know, the sisterhood of women throughout the centuries. But it's also this, you know, you speak about women's spheres and their limited spheres of influence and of activity. Here he has this whole new community, Basir. He can go be a Sufi if he wants to.
I mean.
Right. And that's another fascinating idea, that his foray into the Sufi world, whatever that is, such that it comprises, is within his purview to do. But she can only stay in her place. It seems that she's not this active woman who could make choices about her religion and her lifestyle in this way that her husband can. All she has left to do is try to rein him in, and with whatever power she might have within her home or outside of her home.
Yes, that is definitely the impression we get from this letter and from many other letters. We don't know much about, in terms of conversion to Islam or leaving Judaism, we do find cases where women threaten it. But we found very few cases written down where it actually happens, and certainly not in this kind of social way. And the other thing I will say again, just to reemphasize, is the women who have agency, who can make choices to do things, it's women who have relatives supporting them and who have property. neither of which this woman seems to have. And so she's very sort of constrained in what she can and can't do. And many of the petitions are like this. We find over and over again that women who are left on their own often have small children to support, often are kind of making choices within this sort of sphere of being socially confined, even if they're not literally physically confined to the home. And yet, this letter to me also, I mean, I could be projecting, it could just be the scribe saying all this, but to me, it reads so strongly like a person with a view of her own and a very strongly held conviction of her own, even within her sort of narrow sphere of agency.
Most definitely. Certainly, it sounds like that to people who hear it today. And now we get the opportunity to lift the veil on you, Eve. You spend so much time recovering the minute details of women of old, and contemporary women want to know about you. What do you like to do in your spare time?
So I spend most of my time either taking care of my family and my house and my husband and my kids, or doing my work or reading. Those are pretty much the things that I do. There's really not a lot of time for anything else.
What's your favorite subject to teach?
So honestly, I love teaching texts directly. I teach a class called Everyday Writing in Medieval Egypt. And it's not just about Judaism or Jews in Egypt, but there's a ton of Geniza documents in there. And we cover the social history of Egypt. So everything from how people handled death to how people handled marriage to what trade looked like and how merchants connected with one another, which I have to say is the student's least favorite subject usually, to concepts of religion, to literacy. And we do it all through documents. And I absolutely love teaching that course because the students come in knowing nothing about this world. And because it is so easy to get enraptured with this kind of material and to relate to it, almost always I get term papers that, you know, with some work could be published. Like,
wow.
They really get into the details of it. And it's such a great gateway to really understanding that people who lived in the past were human beings living in a human world just like us. I love teaching that. The other thing that I love teaching is an intro course to Judaism called Great Books of the Jewish Tradition, usually to students who have no background at all. And it's just absolutely phenomenal experience. Just taking each text on its own terms. We obviously only read a little bit of each thing, but often it's students who don't have a background in these texts, and seeing them, you know, read them for the first time is just such a pleasure.
That's amazing. And if you feel comfortable, how does all of this work within the context of our From life? It's so hard. People ask, you know, how do you do it? And there's no one answer, right? But if there is a way that you could share, that's something that you fall back on or something that you pull out of your hat to make people feel special, people in your family, your guests. We want to learn how you do it all.
I'm incredibly lucky because I really, really love my job. I take a lot of personal meaning out of it. And I certainly don't think that everybody has to do that or that you have to have a job that gives you, you know, a sense of sort of meaning in and of itself. But I think if you want that, it's really wonderful. And for me, it's kind of incredible because yes, it's very difficult. It's a difficult balancing act. Like all From women in their 40s, I am very tired much of the time. But what I do is something that I really, really, really love and enjoy. So I feel incredibly lucky to have sort of lucked out into this career path. I am not the most organized person. I would say my household runs on sort of constantly reconfiguring what we need to do. At this point, my oldest kids are older and I have a large family, thank God. So there's a lot of chipping in and a lot of different people doing different things. But I think it works because, first of all, my husband is, you know, a huge sort of support and very enthusiastic about my work and understands when I need to hide myself into the office for 8 hours to write a talk that I'm giving the next day that I haven't found time to write until now. My kids, when they were younger, were somewhat less understanding and more annoyed. But as they are getting older and able themselves to read some of this material and to kind of understand what it is that I do, you know, my oldest is now taking Syriac, which is Christian Aramaic,
wow,
which is something that I never thought that she'd be interested in college. My next one wants to be a Jewish manuscript librarian. So they, I think, appreciate it even when they complain.
Yeah.
I've been telling my kids for years, you know, that when I get a job, you know, when I was in grad school, when I get a job, things are going to calm down. When I get tenure, things are going to calm down. So now I just received tenure, which means that I can keep my job.
Mazel tov.
And like they keep reminding me because I thought you said things were going to calm down. Well, not really. But how do I make people feel special? Honestly, this is a very boring answer, but I just try to really talk to my kids, not with any kind of special formula or script, but just to make sure that I know what is going on in their lives. And even if I don't have time to prepare dinners for the week and we end up eating, you know, frozen pizza maybe twice.
Yeah.
I still try to find time to really talk to each one, to be aware of what's going on with them in school and their emotions, et cetera, and to be connected to them. And I would say with guests, it's the same thing. I don't have any secret cake recipes or anything, although we do make a lot of different kinds of food because future manuscript librarian is quite a cook and she has taken over the Shabbos kitchen and will not let me in anymore. And she's a fantastic cook.
That's great.
But I try to just, to the best of my ability, be interested in everybody who comes through our house and really want to know where they're coming from and what they're doing. That's my only trick.
So the same things that make you a world-class scholar also make you an amazing mother and hostess and friend.
Okay, well, I will tell my kids that they should realize this, but yes, thank you.
They can listen to the podcast. What an illuminating journey this has been into the Kairos Geniza. Eve, to us, you're no less than a treasure in our Jewish world, and I thank you so much for your scholarship, your generosity, and for taking the time to share them with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Veiled Reference. Enjoy this episode and share it with your friends. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear from you at podcasts@mishpacha.com. Veiled Reference, a Mishpacha podcast.